Okay. Well, go ahead and open us up in prayer and we'll get started. Father, as we come before you this day, we are grateful and thankful for all that you have blessed us with. Lord, how you continue to work and move and through us and with us. And we pray that you would continue to do that. And we ask that you would open our eyes to see some of these greater issues regarding culture, that we may best know how to respond to you in faithfulness. And that we would pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So the handout is in the back there, if you will find it helpful. Last week we talked about the common view of culture that is more or less prevalent probably in the greater evangelical world, and critiqued it to why this is not a good working model according to James Davison Hunter, and basically understanding that this values approach, this try harder, think better approach, doesn't really have an effect on changing culture. While stating the renewal of hearts and minds are a good thing, they're just not effective in changing culture. So just to keep that in mind, that as we go through some of these things, to emphasize one area or even to critique it in one particular function doesn't mean it's a renouncing of the whole. Sometimes that's difficult. People, they hear something particular and it's hard to kind of move them off track that way. If I emphasize A, it doesn't mean I don't believe in B, sort of thing. So to be aware of that as well. Sometimes you hear something, an emphasis that you haven't heard before, and it's almost automatic. Well, that's against B. No, both of those things can be true. Had a very exhausting conversation earlier in the week with someone that very, very point. Yes, and the minute I say yes, it was like, no, this. No, I'm saying this and this. And I say that, and well, you're not saying no, and it's back and forth and back and forth. So do understand that, and sometimes you hear things for the first time and just to hear them. And hopefully having some of these things printed out will be helpful for that. So this comes right out of James Hunter's To Change the World. And we're going to go through that. On the front page is 7 propositions of culture. On the back side are 4 more propositions on change of culture. So there's 11 altogether. And we're going to go through them one at a time, because he is presenting an alternate view of culture. I think many of these propositions are very helpful for us in understanding. They're not the only way that this can be viewed. I think they're some of the most helpful, and there have been critiques of Hunter's critique. But we will use his material anyhow as we get going. You may want there's a handout at the front there that you might want. Right there is a, just so you're aware. We'll be going through that, and it might be nice to have that. So his first proposition on culture. Culture is a system of truth claims and moral obligations. Nothing too dramatic about that. A system of truth claims and moral obligations. So what does that mean? Sometimes we refer to these as norms, or he refers to them as commanding truths. That's the shoulds and should nots that we experience in any given society. What should we do? What should we not do? And so culture is a system of truth claims about moral obligations. But all that's to say is that these truth claims as a whole do not exist as a set of propositions. So he's giving us a set of propositions, and he's going to say, yes, but culture doesn't work that way. These truth claims are not given as a set of propositions to us. Really, they're more of embedded stories that have overlapping themes, and there are stories and myths of any culture that reinforce basic ideas. So, yes, sir. Sure. I'll go forward with that, and we'll see if it ties some of these things together. So as we think about embedded stories, that is what it means to be a part of a worldview. Worldview is usually what is super embedded in our consciousness. And it's the part of our understanding that we always take for granted. It's how we view time, how we view space, how we view identity. It's the reality that we experience around us. And so a lot of the things that we hold to come to us, again, not in propositions, but more like sayings, adages, aphorisms. You know, a penny saved is a penny earned. That kind of thing. Well, a penny saved is a penny earned, especially if you look in the 1930s culture of America coming out of the Depression. That was just, you know, waste not, want not. Well, that's a part of an embedded story. It's not just an expression. It comes out of a heartfelt view of life around you. So that's how you heard it. You heard it in terms of waste not, want not, a penny saves, a penny earned. So that would be an example of that, like especially in the 30s. And I remember, my grandparents would save tinfoil because it came out of World War II. But they'd also save every container imaginable. And my other grandpa, we'd tear down a shed. I'd pull out the nails and have to straighten all the nails out and put them in a bucket. And after he died, there were dozens and dozens of containers of nuts, bolts, screws, and nails that had been, you know, because that was a part of an ethos, a culture of you don't waste because you came from difficult times. And so this, it wasn't like a proposition of you are not supposed to waste anything. That is wrong. It was everyone just had a general value in a sense of waste not, want not. A penny saves, a penny earned. And so that belief got carried into the language, the embeddedness of how people conducted their life, and no one thought about it in any deep way. You just did it. And that's what he's saying, is that most of the time that we have these sets of beliefs, we have these worldviews, and they are pre-reflective. And it goes along with language as well. That's why when you learn a language of a culture, every language conveys certain things that are embedded in it of the narrative of that language, that you are always an outsider to some degree until you learn the language. Because the language carries with it a lot of these undercurring, swirling ideas that are part now of the basic way people communicate, different than another language. So that's why we cannot merely just change worldviews or question a worldview easily. Most of the time, people are not even aware of what is directing or shaping them. And it operates at a level that a lot of people are not capable of consciously grasping. So culture is a system of truth claims and moral obligations, yes. And most of those are not things people articulate very well. They're not aware that they're there. And when you talk about them and when you butt up against them, that's when people start to either get offended or wonder what's going on. Like, well, what are you talking about? Or I'm saying something different than what you're hearing. That happens too. Like, I'm talking about this thing and you're hearing me like, oh yeah, you're talking about this thing. No. The water around us is fish. This is what it looks like. Oh yes. Those people have water around them they're swimming in. No, we do too. Yes, I see it. It's gone. It takes a lot of effort to consciously think about the unconscious things around us. And it is hard. And so that's why worldview and worldview change is so difficult, because most of the time we're just not even aware of it. You hear things said and you're like, well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And you move on. Again, maybe not so much in this time period, but especially, you know, let's say 1980s, 1990s. It's just assumed by American culture that democracy is the best way to run any country. And so as you speak about how to interact and what should happen in other countries, you just assume, well, the best thing for them is to be a democracy. It's not even a question of, well, is it good for their culture? And so people don't even have any other assumption other than that. And I think that's one of the things that we found out, especially in the Gulf War, that just bringing democracy into a culture doesn't do anything for it. In fact, it actually has negative effects, because there's a lot of things that go into a democracy other than just, you know, right to vote. there's a whole cultural worldview that if they don't share, it doesn't work. And that's what you saw in you know, the former Soviet Union. That's what you see in a lot of the Islamic countries. And there's just sort of an American assumption that, well, everybody wants democracy. Well, that's a part of a worldview. That's a part of a sense of, here's this underlying thing that governs who we are that we don't really articulate, that we all believe. So it's a system of truth, claims, and moral obligations that shape us. The second one is culture is a product of history. And so that also tells us that there's a very slow process over time for a meaning in history, for a significance in a culture that is a part of that. It's just a part of the culture is the history that comes with it. So culture is not so much an invention of what somebody wants as a slow product of history. So it isn't simply that we just go, well, we're going to have this kind of a culture. It's just over time, this is what we end up with. And it happens through all these historical processes that most of us aren't even aware of that function. They sometimes are what people refer to as a habit, a collective habit. The past always survives in the present. And history gets turned into our nature in terms of our habit. A second nature, if you will, because we're not really thinking about it. And it doesn't mean then that history is a closed system because it comes out of a history. It is open, but it can be modified only through time most of the time. Things are not easily changed because of the history. There is an inertia that is built into culture by virtue of its relationship to it's a very long history. And it's just kind of lumbering along. Sometimes it's fairly erratic. Sometimes it's moving straight. Sometimes not. And you are not going to change it easily. Again, when you think about American democracy, you think about an innate fairness to how most Americans function with lots of ideas. You see this in the Olympics, for instance. We have, and not saying, again, this is a good thing. We have an innate sense of fairness that has developed historically over time. We get really angered when people cheat in sports. It just ticks us off as a people. We don't like it when our own people cheat, and we want to strip them of their medals when they get caught. Not because they brought shame to us, because it is just wrong. It's a good part of history. It's a good thing. There's an innate fairness in Americans. Other parts of the world don't share that at all. It's the good of the nation at whatever cost. You just do what is good for the country. You lie, cheat, or steal if it makes our country look good. And as long as we can get away with it, this is the value. And we run into that and we just like, how in the world can people live like this? This is so self-evidently wrong. Well, that's because of a good history coming to us about fairness and rightness that another culture doesn't share. And so to change that within us would be really, really difficult. We have just got this innate sense of fairness. Other nations around the world would talk about that. We just maybe they admire it, maybe not. I don't know. We'd say it's a good thing for sure. I mean, I think you certainly can show biblical warrant for it. But that's an inertia involved that if someone starts cheating in the Olympics, we're not secretly like, yeah, stick it to the Russians. We're like, that's wrong. Kick their butt out of there. You know, we don't want them to succeed that way. And that's a part of the history. We are a development of history over time. So that's just an example. But we are a collection of all the things that have gone before us. And those things carry a certain weight that's hard to identify. It's hard to change. Some of it makes sense. Some of it doesn't. That's where the old saying goes, well, why are we doing it that way? We've always done it that way. Well, I'm going to change it. Good luck. You may, but the likelihood is it's going to take a really, really long time. That's why we say you can't fight City Hall. For other reasons we'll see as well, but one of them is history. It's just like, this is what you got to do. And everyone collectively is aware of that, but not aware of it. So our history carries with it a sense of habit that we've developed. The third one it's, now this is, we're going to hit a little more on the philosophical end, but that's okay. Culture is intrinsically dialectical. Dialectical speaks of two competing ideas. You'll hear, in fact, the sermon today is going to talk about that, you know, God's sovereignty and human responsibility. So you hear of two ideas and how these things interchange. It comes to us, most of the time, a lot of truth comes to us in terms of this interplay between two differences. And the formal word for that is dialectics, something's dialectical. And according to Hunter, there are two ways of doing this. You have ideas and you have institutions. You have individuals and you have institutions. What that means is that ideas are not simply free-floating in consciousness. They're grounded in the world around us. So culture is an infrastructure, according to Hunter, of these ideals. They're concrete institutional forms that ideas and institutions are interwoven, and they work. So people can have individual thoughts, but they also have them embedded in the fabric of society, all the things that are there, the market, the state, the education, media, mass communication, science, technology, the family, all of these things are institutions with ideas running in them. And if you don't understand that, there's a failure to integrate this idea, especially as a Christian, sometimes we forget that, you know, it's just all about ideas. No, it's about institutions which carry these ideas, and individuals are also related to institutions. We are a highly individualistic society. We pride ourselves on that. That's one of those governing themes that is a part of American culture, but it's also a part that has blinded us because we're not as individualistic as we think. We are not free from the institutions that surround us that make up ideas. And institutions then have much greater power than we realize. The ideas and people are inseparable from institutions. You cannot understand these things apart from the fact that they're interrelated. And we often, again, we think there's an illusion of this, that somehow we are free from all this. And not saying they're balanced. They're not an equal balance, but they are a part of all of this. So that's probably one of the harder ones to grasp, is that ideas and institutions run together, individuals and institutions run together. They are separate to certain degrees, and they are also a matrix at other points. Institutions have power. And if we don't get that one, we're going to mess up a whole lot of other things. Yes, sir? Sure. And we'll actually get to that a little later. And actually what you're saying, we'll get to here shortly, because there are occasions where things do happen quickly. Most of the time, when you actually examine them, they are not quick. Manifest destiny, we started talking about in the 1620s, Puritans coming to America. What are we? We're a city on a hill. How does city on a hill differ from manifest destiny? Not by very much. So there's links to that woman's suffrage, these things in the 60s. They're all tied to a long history as well. So what you'll see, this is my understanding of it. It seems to work as an analogy. Maybe there's others. Like when you have a piece of ice floating, this ice float, and you have something on it, you slide everything to one end, and the ice just flips over instantly, you know, just whoop. Well, because it took all that weight to shift it. If you're on the ice flow, it feels like it happened instantaneously. But you realize, no, there's all this weight that got shifted and slid to one edge, and that could have taken decades. So as we look at, you know, the acceptance of our culture of homosexuality and same-sex marriage, it's just like this came just so fast. Well, no, it actually didn't. We were sliding, and then once the weight hit and it flipped, as we're going to talk about how change occurs, it makes sense. So we'll keep those ideas in because I think we'll cover them. Proposition 4, culture is a resource as such a form of power. So what he's talking about is that there are symbols in any given culture. And he doesn't mean just, you know, like a symbol, like the American flag is a symbol. He's saying that symbols take the form of ideas, information, news, wisdom, knowledge of all kinds, speech, tracts, books, symbols in the form of knowledge, technical know-how, your credentials, your accomplishments, and all of those in culture are understood as capital, symbolic capital. Unlike and like money. So if you have cultural capital because of symbols of your learning, your expertise, the things that you have done, that can't be transferred to another generation. So your giftedness, your ability, everything you've earned for you doesn't go to somebody else because, you know, they're related to you. If you've earned, let's see, would be a form of that. If you're a teacher, it doesn't mean your kids are going to be teachers. So, and what you have accrued in your educational process doesn't go to them necessarily by virtue of being family. But like money, you can accumulate more capital, more symbolic capital. So he has many examples of it. I think sometimes some of these things are easier to understand in their examples than maybe in the overall meaning. If you are a Nobel Prize winner in literature, it has more symbolic capital than if you write a romance novel. The New York Times has more symbolic capital than the Daily Interlake. Harvard University has more capital than FECC. There's symbolic capital that comes with these institutions or with these ideas. They are not the same. You cannot just say, you know, because of this, you know, we're all equal. I have a degree, you have a degree. No, no, no. Where the degree comes from carries with it power. Culture is not neutral in relationship to power and forms of power. So the symbolism carries with it the legitimacy of meaning. Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote about the difficulties in the gulag. Lots of people wrote about the gulag. Why was he heard and no one else? Well, he's a Nobel Prize winner. And we do the same thing. 100 points is out. It's like book blurbing. You can take a very mediocre book and somebody on the back who you respect says, this book is awesome, and you buy it. And you might think, this is a great book because whoever, I mean, pick your celebrity who endorsed it. That means something to us. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just how the world works. It's that way, whether you like it or not. I come from a family of mechanics. Lots of mechanics in my family. I have a fairly good mechanical aptitude. Learned a lot about mechanics on my own. So have a pretty good understanding of mechanics. If you have car trouble and your mechanic and I are standing side by side and we disagree on what your car trouble is, you are rightly going to weigh his opinion more than mine, even though I might be right. In the same way, the PhD matters in academic settings. There are people much smarter than me. There are people much smarter than many PhD students. But when it comes to having influence, you know, you can mess up the influence, but the first thing that happens is you're going to go to people who are usually have a certain amount of authority in their area. It's just automatically conferred to them. They can lose it, but you're going to grant it to them. In the same way, if you have a doctor from Fargo State or Johns Hopkins, automatically you're going to assume the Johns Hopkins doctor is better, just the way that it is, versus Fargo Medical School. That is how that works, and we're kidding ourselves if we don't understand that. That there is, within culture, its resources and such are a form of power. And that is huge in our understanding as we move forward. That there's not all symbols are the same, and they create a form of power. So, 5. Cultural production and symbolic capital are stratified in a fairly rigid structure of center and periphery. This really is an extension of the last one, but just a little more detail. when it comes to cultural capital, it isn't about quantity, it is quality that matters. The status of cultural credentials and accomplishments is not equal. It's about quality. And so what that means, as we go back to, the USA Today sells a gazillion more newspapers than the New York Times. But what somebody writes in the op-ed in New York Times is way more important culturally than what's given in the USA Today. It's just how it's going to be. The same way with publishing books. There are certain publishers in the Christian world that we're all familiar with, and one book by Oxford, one book by Knopf, they just are weighted far more than Zondervan or Erdmann's. Just they are. So there's a hierarchy of this, and we see it in everything. You know, BMW versus Chevy. There are some things that are more central and some things that are more periphery to culture. And so the capital that you gain will have a greater influence in the middle, or it moves a little further out to the edge. Culture, then, number six, is generated within networks. There is an idea out there, and he notices it comes from Thomas Carlyle, who's a 19th century Scottish historian, and it carried a lot of sway, that history is about the biography of great men. That when you look across history, there's this great person, and historically they're men, so not trying to ruffle feathers, but when you look at the overall understanding of history, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy changed history. And Carlyle was a great advocate of that. And Hunter is saying he is wrong. He's only partially correct. Because great people are only great if they are connected to other institutions. That the key factors in people who have done things in history do so because there's a network that allows that to take place. So you have a Martin Luther, you have a William Wilberforce, a Dorothy Day, giants in some areas, but the charisma and the genius does not exist outside of the networks that enable them to carry that weight forward. So what that means is there's lots of really bright, charismatic geniuses we've never heard of who haven't done anything for culture. Because that in itself doesn't work. They have to be connected with other relationships to allow that to take place. And every great person, you usually see there's interwovenness to connections to some form of institution or overlapping institutions that allows them to be heard. Otherwise, they're just a nut on a street. And that's that way all the time. It's in church culture. There are some really bright, creative people who have said things. I think that is really a very valid thing for, you know, our denomination to know. They're periphery people. They're not in the institutions, the center. They get pushed out. They don't get listened to. It's just a fact of life. And we need to know that, that it isn't just about being great. It's about being connected and great. So you need both. And that's not all bad, but it's just how it functions. Proposition 7, culture is neither autonomous nor fully coherent. That's, again, part of that interconnectedness. It's complex, it's interrelated, and all these differing institutions overlap, so nothing stands by itself. And because of that, and because of the history, because of the complexity, it isn't necessarily super coherent. It isn't like, again, you just write down and collect all these ideas and go, well, this is what it is. It's some of that, but there's a lot of it that even seems to be contradictory because different institutions are somewhat at war with one another, even though we overlap in this part, but we differ in this part, like a Venn diagram. And so that exists all the time. So while you have some things that are coherent and agreeable, you have other parts that work against each other. You know, institutions of the state can work with institutions of entertainment, and they can be against them at times, and at the same time. So that's what we see, that there's not this really easy idea that culture just is quite definable. it stands apart on its own, and it's easy to understand. It's fairly complex. So that's his seven propositions. Zooming through. And now he's going to shift on the other side to his four propositions on cultural change. So given that these things seem to make up culture, how in the world do we change it? And he's still having to answer the question of, you know, should that even be our main job? So he basically, Hunter is saying that if he's right, that if we don't know how this all comes together, most of our efforts are going to be wasted, because we're going to take something that's fairly complex and we're going to try to oversimplify it, and we're not going to do that. This understanding of ideas have consequences, we've all heard that, came from a 1948 book published by Richard Weaver from the University of Chicago. There is some truth to that, certainly. Ideas have consequences, but we're going to see he's going to take that and nuance it in a better way. Of course, ideas have consequences, but not all ideas have the same consequences. John Maynard Keynes, probably a well-known economist from England, he wrote a little book on the general employment, of theory of employment, and he said this. He goes, "Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbles of a few years back." He talks about the gradual encroachment of ideas. Ideas have some consequences. Much of the time, we're not even aware that they're operating, and they don't have the same consequences. Under specific conditions and certain circumstances, some ideas have consequences. So what are the conditions and what are the circumstances? And that's what these four propositions are going to talk about. It is sometimes true, culture change from the top down rather than from the bottom up. It's a major component of his system and of his understanding. I think it's very accurate. It can seem like revolutions, revolts start at the grassroots level and work their way up. There may even be examples of that. Most of the time, those things are short-lived. They don't last because they don't connect to all the other institutions that need to take place. And much of the time, what we think is a grassroots level change, really at its heart, isn't. It's still affected by the top. So even when you think of some great revolution, who are the major players? They may not have been the center, but they were still in the top tier. Marx was not just a common worker. He came from a family of means. You see this time and again, that what seems to be people who are just scrappy people struggling from the bottom are usually well-connected people who have other people supporting behind them. But those people typically come from not the bottom, but from the higher tier of society with the support of the bottom. Most of the time, again, this is just general rules. And so right, wrong, or indifferent, the gatekeepers of society typically are at the top. Revolutions, if they are going to overturn the top, have to have somebody connected to the top for it to be long-lasting, or otherwise it's short-lived. You can get some slight changes for a short period of time that do not have a long result. And that's a huge one to understand. Cultural change is more enduring when it penetrates the structures of our imagination, the things that formulate our knowledge and our discussions, how we understand the world around us. When those type of things as a whole can be started to be connected, then you're going to see this grassroots change. But it comes from the top to the bottom, not from the bottom to the top in most all cases, if it's going to be lasting. Second, change is typically initiated by elites who are outside the centermost positions of prestige. And he carries this idea from an Italian theorist, Vilfredo Pareto. And he talks about foxes and lions. And foxes are the people who are innovative, who are trying to get things changed. They have ideas. And the lions are sort of the status quo people. They're the ones who are in power. And you cut this constant war between foxes and lions. And when a fox changes things, after a while, he becomes a lion. And then new foxes arrive. All that is to say is that all that takes place still at the top within center periphery of elite culture, typically. So even when we see some charismatic guy who's not in the wheelhouse of power, he's only just removed by a step or two. So he didn't go to Harvard, but, you know, he went to another Ivy League school. You know, the Boston Globe isn't the New York Times, but it's better than the USA Today in terms of cultural influence. So a lot of the movers and shakers who we see, like, they're outside of the system. They're not really outside of the system. It happens in politics all the time. We think, oh, this is the man of the people. It's like, well, he's not in the center, but he's hardly a man of the people. He just knows how to connect with people. And then we have this sense of, oh, we got an anti-establishment guy. Well, he's not really that far out of the establishment. His ideas aren't that radical. He just now wants to be the guy in charge. So that happens typically about the change. It got center elite and then periphery elites. And if it's outside of that, not as much change takes place. And then over time, as those changes happen, the changers become the status quo people. So Proposition 11. Cultures change, but rarely, if ever, without a fight. It is the nature of cultures to remain fluid and static. So change is slow, change is over time, it is possible, but it doesn't come easily if people are going to do something different. There usually is a conflict that happens that initiates the change to take place. It doesn't mean it has to have a conflict, it's just one of the main components that there is a conflict. Usually, again, from one of these people outside of the center, still not top tier, who start pushing and complaining or doing. And because they're connected to these other institutions, culture shifts. And that's, again, where you, to me, where you see the sliding take place and something flips. It's like, it happened overnight. Not really. But it did take a conflict to push it. And then that's what happens. It changes. So this understanding, then, when we look at the difficulties of changing culture and how complex it is, short of, you know, if you're going to come in like in a war and one people dominate another, you can change the culture pretty fast, you know, that way. But most of the time, these things are slow accretions, and they don't come like people think they do. So, for instance, you know, James Dobson, in one generation, you can change the whole culture. In Hunter's view, that's nothing short of ludicrous. Conditions can occur relatively quickly, but the most profound changes in culture usually are generational. They usually don't happen too fast. Can be. And then when you look at it, you usually find a long history of, oh, that's why that took place. And so even this idea that, you know, if we go and we can evangelize and we change the hearts of the people, it may have an impact on that particular generation, but if it doesn't go into these other institutional forms, it won't have a lasting impact. And it takes a lot of time and effort, and lots of time. It's not even something that we can really consciously change, even if we try, because of the complexity of how it works. An axis of that would be, you know, think of the temperance movement. Had this great idea of people trying to, let's get rid of alcohol, and it's horrible and it's evil, and then 1933, the Volstead Act turned it on its head. It didn't have a lasting influence in America, even though it had a lot of moral support by a lot of movers and shakers for a fair amount of time. It didn't really transform things at an institutional level of the elites. So you go, it's a grassroots effort, and look, we changed the law, we got this, and people are all excited, we're going to change our country, and, you know, well, it didn't. Because it didn't have an effect on those upper level institutions and how they function, and it lost momentum and shifted and got kicked out. Same way we could have a third great awakening, and we could have lots of people's hearts touched, lots of people churning, but if it isn't a part of the cultural gatekeepers, it's not going to affect the symbols of the culture that carry the power that brings about the change. So if it's not tied to structural changes in culture, it probably is going to have a limited view. And often Christians have a very naive view of how that works. And often we're disappointed because of that. And we also got to remember, the Puritans who founded Harvard and Yale would not have expected that their institutions so quickly would have become strongholds of secularity. You can never predict where things are going to go. That's the other thing to know about culture. There's no way to fully know. And you see that if you're a business startup. You can have all the capital, the right idea, the right people, and it doesn't go anywhere. You know, there's that intangible thing, that it, that something that happens, that something takes off and goes, and you can't really produce that. Because if you could, everyone would be doing it all the time. It's like, why did Facebook take off and MySpace didn't? MySpace was first. You know, there are tons of things like that. Well, why? Because something just takes place that's not always explicable. And we have to be aware of that you can't predict how these things are going to go. And so if we're going to engage culture effectively, much less hope to change it, we need to know at least the factors that go into it. We still haven't answered the question of how we should be doing that or even what the rationale would be. But if we don't understand how the game is played, we're not ever going to move from the start. So that is a quick overview of Hunter's ideas of culture, what culture is, and then some ideas of how to change it. Yes, Jim. Yes, world-changing, most contrary when the networks of elites and institutions, they lead overlap. So, Harvard, the New York Times, senators from New England, boom, 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 all those things have overlapping connections. And the more overlapping they are like that, then that's how those things will change. If you focus on just one of those, it won't happen. So there's education, there's media. And media makes up news, entertainment, overlapping circles of institutions. And I don't know, there's lots of them. Seven's often listed. But if you don't have a hand on multiple institutions and only change one of them, nothing's going to take place. That's why it's also very hard in our country, just simply with the educational system, there's a monopoly on it for the most part. Well, that makes it difficult to change. For good or bad. And that's, for instance, that's also a system like in the Presbyterian USA, how their government is structured, that it's very top heavy and not so much grassroots. Well, once the top shifts, it's almost impossible to reform. Our system of government is separate from that because of that. We don't have, it's not top heavy. It's more in the middle to be able to make that change. So these overlapping institutions can be so interconnected that if you change one and you're not aware of the others, it won't have any long-lasting effect. So, all right, people are going to come in, and I'll say a quick prayer, and we'll be done. Father, we do pray for more understanding in these areas that we would be able to better know how to live and interact in the world around us as Christians. And, Father, that you would help us to know, again, how we can be faithful in the small areas that exist for us. And we pray that you would bring change to a world in desperate need. Father, we need the freeing power of the gospel, and we ask that you would blow afresh upon us. And we would ask that in Jesus' name.